Hi, welcome back to Law and Legitimacy. This is Norm Pattis, and believe it or not, we're already at episode 26 or 27. I want to thank Mike Boyer of the Kraft Carolina Legal Group again for his invaluable technical assistance. And I know Mike will chastise me privately for this episode because in the background you will hear the noise of a busy kitchen. That's because today I'm in the home of one of America's great trial lawyers and perhaps one of the most, maybe not the most, but one of the most creative human beings I know, R. Rex Parris. And it's my pleasure to be a guest in his home this week while we work on some problems in a case we both care deeply about. Rex is the principal of the Parris Law Firm in Lancaster, California. He does large class action and personal injury work, and he's the kind of guy you go to when your life falls apart and you're looking for justice. He's also the mayor of Lancaster, and I got to tell you how cool it is to be walking around town thinking, hey, I'm a guest in the mayor's home, so I dare you to say something to me. He is also the president of Carthonics, a medical company of some sort that he's tried to explain to me any number of times, but it's gone over my head each time. He's recognized around the world for his work in climate sustainability, and Lancaster is a leading city in the world, frankly, in the development of, in particular, hydrogen power, and he may soon even be speaking overseas on the topic. I'll let him tell you all about that if we get to it. But in the hour we're going to spend together today, what I'd like to talk to him about is trials, because what fascinates me about Rex is his skill in the courtroom. Now, he's modest. He'll tell you, hey, I didn't even graduate from high school. And that's true. But he has self-taught himself cognitive sciences, and he'll tell you how that came to be. And he's transformed the courtroom into a scientific laboratory that I'll let him describe. I don't even think I can do justice to it. I like to think I know my way around the courtroom, but every time I talk to Rex, I learn something. And what I've learned is there's more to the world than I can see and more than I can easily understand. So, without further ado, welcome Rex Parris.
Thank you. Thank you. I liked your explanation of it.
Well, what is trial? And well, first of all, tell the ladies and gentlemen listening to this a little bit about you. You're a lawyer. How long have you been a lawyer? What kind of law do you practice?
I've been a lawyer a really long time, you know, almost 40 years, if not more. And I do personal injury and class actions and environmental. And sometimes I do civil rights, Voter Rights Act cases. You know, it's whatever interesting. You know.
Would you describe yourself as a trial lawyer?
Yeah, I think I can safely say that's what I am.
Let's talk about that. What is a trial lawyer?
Well, you know, a trial lawyer is what it says. It's somebody who goes in, stands in front of 12 people, and pleads their case. We have all kinds of other people that you know, and I was one of them. Don't get me wrong. You know, first 5-6 years, I like to say I was a trial lawyer, but rarely would I confront those fears and actually do it. And being a trial lawyer is, for cognitive reasons, one of the most frightening things you can do. And, you know, whenever I say that, I always have a Marine in the back of the room, you know, to remind me that he was in combat. But interestingly enough, it's similar. And it's similar because of what's happening in our limbic brain, you know, underneath the cortex.
Well, don't get too far ahead of my you're talking to ordinary people here. I didn't know I had an extra brain. I've got a limbic brain here. Limbic cortex. Break this down for us.
Okay. Well, you know, there's many ways to look at the anatomy of the brain. But, you know, the center of your brain, you know, that regulates your heart rate and your breathing and I'm running a blank of...
Yeah, autonomic responses, the stuff you don't have to think about, all junk that goes on when you're on.
But interestingly enough, it has far more effect on how we make decisions and think than we knew 10 years ago. You know, it seems as if most decisions are actually getting... If you're measuring it by being able to predict what the decision is going to be, and, you know, in very simple, you know, binary decisions, yes, no, you know, you by just watching an fMRI machine as a person makes those decisions, you can predict it about a second before.
Well, and when you say fMRI, you're talking about field magnetic resonance imaging?
That's what I'm talking about.
So basically, no, you can get an image of the brain, and are you saying that based on the limbic response to things, before a person becomes aware of things, you're able to say what they're going to do? Is that really true? Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And this is all rooted in the limbic system?
Yeah, and so what that means is it really supports the notion that free will and is really an illusion.
Let's talk about that more later. But so, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I hear it said that trial is a search for the truth. Do you believe that?
Well, certainly that is an abstract metaphor that could be applied. But do I believe that in the actual functionality of a trial?
Right.
I think that's the goal, but I think that is probably rarely a substantive goal.
I get concerned and scared when I hear you talk because I think of truth as something that can be recognized and shared intersubjectively and perhaps relied upon, but you're describing it as an abstract metaphor, as though it stands in for something else.
No, what I described was the search for truth as an abstract metaphor. Interestingly enough, truth is not a word I use anymore because if you use it in front of a jury, it creates suspicion and you lower credibility. You use accurate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They respond much more favorably to the word accurate. And it also, causes you to be a little better at what you do. Mm. If you're looking for accuracy, that's much different than this vague thing called truth,
So what role, as I've known you, when we met, it was 25 years ago, it was out in Dubois, Wyoming, we were on Jerry Spence's ranch, and we'd gone through psychodrama and howled at the moon and gone through exercises. I don't think you were paying attention to cognitive sciences at that point.
Actually, I had. That's when I started reading. I started reading about the, free will being an illusion. I was starting in that direction, but I was primarily interested at the time in neuro-linguistic programming, which was, kind of a fad science, pseudoscience, that a lot of people have gotten into. But over the years, as we do more and more research in the in cognitive science, about 70% of what they had to say was valid.
What is cognitive science?
Well, that's a good question. It's the science of how we think and feel.
Wow, you said a lot there. Sometimes people say, I believe in science. I mean, I think of science simply as a method for arriving at the truth or what you might say an accurate description of reality. Would that be a good
answer? Yes, okay. And is it replicable? Once you discover a truth, mm-hmm. can you replicate it?
Okay.
That's the hallmark of it. And it's also, can you predict? Can you take this knowledge that you've developed in the lab or, in the universities or whatnot, and can you predict outcomes based on it? And I mean, that's what I'm interested in the courtroom. Can I predict how the jury's going to respond, how the witness is going to respond, how the judge is going to respond if I do certain things, And there's a great many things that are predictable.
Somehow that threatens me. I guess I'm a diehard in free will, and I want people to. I want to believe I'm persuading people to give their assent to truths. I suppose. I guess I'm a little antiquated, so I need you to educate me. This business of predictability. Do you believe that if your case is adequately prepared, you have a high confidence level in the outcome?
Once I see who the jury is.
Tell me more.
Well. We attempt to horizontally segment the jury, meaning, you want me to tell you about horizontal segment?
You better.
Segmentation?
Yeah, you better tell everybody.
That was one of the first things that I got involved in about 15, 20 years ago with Howard Moskowitz. He came out of Harvard. He's a psychophysicist. He's really a cool guy. I fell in love with the guy. He can trace his academic lineage to Freud. Mm-hmm. Freud taught this guy who taught Howard. Really they're really into that stuff at Harvard.
So horizontal segmentation, what does that mean?
Well, what he came up with is, you know, he left the university when he got his PhD and went into taste, you know, and because there was a lot of money in taste, and he was also vilified for that back then, you know, mixing, leaving academia to make money was not really something you did back then, but he did it. And so he started working, you know, like for different food companies, because if you can maintain the taste of something with a cheaper product, you know, that's millions and millions of
profits.
So
when you're referring to taste, you're not talking about my preference for things. You're talking about the actual taste of it.
The taste buds,
yeah, okay,
right.
Okay.
And so, you know, like, but what he kept seeing was there was no uniformity in the data. The data points were all over the map. And an example of that was, I think, Folgers Coffee came to him, right, and said, make us the most perfect coffee. And, you know, by that time he knew enough, and he was able to say, that's impossible. There is no perfect coffee. But there's perfect coffees, you know, meaning that you first have to segment your market, the tastes of your audience, right? And with coffee, he found four primary groups that, you know, and you do it on a scale of 1 to 100, and about the best you could get with you know, if you went for one coffee, that you got close to a 60, but not quite 60, you know. But if you divided it into four, you got to high 70s, wow, you know, and likability of the coffee. And so that started it. And, you know, then Campbell's Soup came to him and said, make us the perfect spaghetti sauce. Well, by this time,
yes,
he knew.
Yes.
Well, Campbell's Soup had Prego. Prego's a much better, ask anybody who cooks, Prego's a better spaghetti sauce than Ragu. But Ragu was killing them, you know, 10 to 1, you know, 10 times the sales. And so Howard, you know, works his magic. And now I think there's 44 varieties of Ragu and 36 varieties of Prego just by horizontal segmentation of the market.
So how does that work for jurors? Are you saying there are types of jurors?
Yes, very much so.
And so what are those types?
Well, it's hard to name them because it really is fact determinative.
Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, they really... but I'll get to this.
Sorry.
Great. So then Howard ended up getting away from taste and started doing this for advertising, you know. How do you make the billboard? You know, what market do you want? What segment of the market do you want to appeal to? You know, like for a personal injury firm, I want to appeal to the wife and mother of the family, because it turns out she makes the decision what lawyer to go to. So that's where we try to focus our advertising.
You're not being a little autobiographical there, are you?
Well, certainly that's how it's done in my house.
All right, I got that.
Which is okay. I mean, you know, that's why we're as successful as we are, is we've segmented the duties.
Right.
You know, I'm not allowed to touch a checkbook. I don't even know where she banks. You know, I'm not allowed to know. Anyway, so he wrote this book, Selling Blue Elephants. I read it. And so
Selling Blue Elephants, okay.
Yeah.
And this is Mike Moskowitz?
No.
Howard Moskowitz,
sorry. Yeah. So I sent him an email. I said, you know, Dr. Moskowitz, can we do this with juries? You know, could we figure out how to segment the case for the jury? And, you know, I didn't hear anything. And, you know, it's not unusual when I write these guys. And, but then 6-7 months later, I get an email. Yes, we can. You know, we did a study. And what they did is they did a study. They took a mock trial. You know, you had lawyer friends and put it together. And the goal of this study is by figuring out, because you're not just looking for the segment of the jury. You're looking at what they want to hear that will move them, right?
Move. And what is the move? What is it moved?
In this case, moving the dial would be making them more likely to give somebody the death penalty.
Okay.
And they found incredible things, which is borne out in other research we've done, is that people my age, you know, I'm 69, people my age, I'm much more likely to want to pull the trigger, give them the death penalty, if Did they mutilate the body? Did they rape the victim? Did they torture the victim? You know, horrendous things they do to the victim, right? But, you know, younger people, when we did the study, it was Generation X. You know, now we've gone through Y to millennials, right? But I don't think much has changed in this regard.
I think we're upon the era of Generation Zombie. I'm sorry to offend those of you under 20.
So everybody tells me. But the Generation X group, they were much more likely to give death if, did the family have to move, the family of the victim? Did the family of the victim have to go on welfare? You know, all of it was focused on what happened to those left behind, you know? And they, it was very easy for them to pull the switch if that occurred and if you emphasize those facts. So we immediately put that in, and how we do jury trials with them is we divide it.
Well, translate this into a PI context. I get the death penalty, you know, but...
Yeah, well, it's really easy. But as soon as we learned it, our verdicts just skyrocketed.
You quantitatively saw a correlation you attribute this to causation. You say that your verdicts increased because...
Substantially, yeah.
Because you did what?
Well... There's a couple things. Now I look at the panel. If it's a young panel, you know, or for the young people on the panel, you know, you want to decide how you're approaching them and what you're selling. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean, you know, but that's what
we're
trying
to persuade them about, right?
Yeah. So with the younger the jurors, the more likely I am, like if I have a loss of consortium case.
And loss of consortium is?
Care, comfort, and society.
Of a companion, right?
Right. Okay. Most lawyers, and we were the same, we would settle those cases out. And it's really uncomfortable to deal with it, you know, how they were having sex, you know, how they're having it now. Everybody gets a little embarrassed by it. And I was the same as everybody else. I was uncomfortable. And so I find ways to settle that, thinking it wasn't very valuable. Mm-hmm. Well, now we get between 10 and 50% of whatever the primary award is, you know, for the person that was injured. Mm-hmm. They will match that, but up to 50% for the wife or the husband.
And what is the factor that you've identified that makes that possible?
Because that age group of jurors... is extremely concerned about impact on the family.
Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. Okay,
and that also is your witness for that impact.
Okay,
see if the victim does it, the person who's hurt does it. If he can do it, it sounds a little whiny, mm-hmm. you know. And because primarily it's he's speculating mm-hmm. as to what is happening to them. Mm-hmm. Better to have them say it. Mm-hmm. And it also gives you the added advantage is, you know, you can bring in another firm mm-hmm. on the loss of consortium.
Okay.
So you get two openings, two closings, two shots at every witness.
I want to focus on the cognitive science. This is the part that, as we've gotten reacquainted mm-hmm. in the last week, you know, I read a fair amount, and I'm not even sucking my thumb. I can't even find my mouth. Where do you start to learn about this cognitive science?
Oh, great story on that. So. Yeah. There's a guy named Robert Sapolsky.
Could you spell the last name?
Sapolsky.
Something. Yeah.
But, you know, I love putting his picture up when I do the presentations because he got a beard down to his knees and, you know, and he's out of Stanford. And I always say, this guy is so smart, he can go to work looking like that. and he really is smart. And but he's a primate neurobiologist. And, you know, the first thing you want to really... We're not much different than, you know... I mean, the politics of chimpanzees is a book that really describes...
Is that one of his books, The Politics of Chimpanzees?
No, it came out in the 70s, but it tracked a tribe of apes in this preserve they created in Europe and tracked them for years. Just like Congress. I mean, you know, not a lot of difference. But anyway, Sapolsky really, you know, incredibly bright. So I sent him an email, and I said, I'd like to become a cognitive scientist, but, you know...
How old were you when you did that?
Probably 50, 55.
So you just decided to send an email to a professor at Stanford saying, I want to become a cognitive scientist?
Yeah, but I can't go to school, so, you know, I got too many things going on. What books should I read? He gave me a reading list, and I'm almost through them. And, but I don't know, you know, I can't wait to get up in the morning to start reading them. And to this day, that is held true. What is happening in the field of cognitive science in the last 20 years is changing the world in so many ways.
Well, take us back to the gene selection, though. You've talked about the younger demographic and the loss of consortium claims and the factors you're looking for. I walk into a room and I've got 40 panelists, wide-ranging in age, and I'm trying to resolve a case involving a catastrophic head injury. I might pick that jury saying, you know, with my kind of one variable trial strategies, I want bounce, people who will listen. But I got a funny feeling you're looking for a lot more than that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, one time I actually interviewed Sapolsky. It was, you know, it was supposed to be a 20-minute interview, and he let me talk to him for 2.5 hours, you know. And by the time we get towards the end of it, I go, oh, I forgot, I got to ask you, tell me something lawyers can use, right? And so he did tell me a few things. And one of the things he told me is he said,
so, ladies and gentlemen, what you hear in the background is the sounds of a busy kitchen. And I'm not going to mention Rex's wife's name. I'm only going to say that she wins Mother of the Year award because when one of her adult children said, I'm in the law office and I'm hungry, I'd like lasagna, she ran to the store to get the ingredients for lasagna and is cooking them now. And she who cooks lasagna rules the Paris household. We will not interrupt her for this podcast. You can't smell the wonderful aroma that we can, but you can hear the work and just deal with it. Now, I suppose, having mentioned lasagna and the sounds of the kitchen, people are going to be salivating because of some neural psychological reason.
It would depend on when they last ate, but some.
So anyhow, walk me back into that room. I'm looking for bounce. You're saying you're missing 90% of the action. What am I missing?
Well, I don't know that the bounce is important if you're looking for connection.
Right.
And connection is always important, but it's not the important thing.
What is?
You know, like what Sapolsky told me is he said, you know, lawyers are always looking for the empathetic person.
Right.
You know, the one that's going to have the most emotional response to what you're saying. And he goes, I don't understand that. He goes, empathetic people rarely do anything. You know, they cry, they get upset, they grind their teeth, they do all those things, but they forget to call 911. And he goes, if you start focusing more on detachment and looking for people who are just a little detached, you're going to get bigger rewards. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be true once I started doing that. But you do have to, you know, you present a different trial to those people.
Yeah, so that's counterintuitive. You know, I would have thought you'd look for the empaths because they'd feel their way into the larger verdict, and you're saying that the feelings might get in the way of the work necessary to accomplish that?
In many ways, too, because, like, he also told me, he said, and why are you guys always trying to make them angry or sad? I read books on mirror cells, so I knew what he was talking about.
And a mirror cell is?
If you don't have them, you can measure where you are on the spectrum, all the way to autism.
Okay.
You know? But like, I can't pronounce the name, he's an Italian guy, and, you know, in Italy, they were in a lab, and by watching the apes, because they hooked them up to electroencephalographs, when the ape would see the scientist, like, eat some ice cream, when they later gave the ape that ice cream, the same pattern in his brain lit up as when he was watching it. Mm-hmm. You know? That's why we can be empathetic, is the mirror cells.
Okay, so a mirror cell is then something that permits us to see someone experiencing something and have that experience for ourselves?
Yes, to some extent.
Is that learned or innate or both?
Well, I don't know how much it's strengthened because neuroplasticity comes into play there. But it's certainly something we're born with.
Okay.
So when I make you angry, when I'm angry, and you're watching it, you feel angry. People don't like to be angry. So what do? They turn to the other side, who's not making them angry. Same thing with sadness. And then later, when I started reading about facial expressions and Ekman, I got in, you know.
Ekman, tell us who Ekman is.
Well, Ekman is the guy who came up with the 6 or 7 universal facial expressions that every human being has. Mm-hmm. And it's contempt, sadness, anger, happiness, I'm drawing a blank.
Something else, yeah.
And now with algorithms, you're able to, and most of that work was done at MIT with Sandy Petland, who started it. You're now able to use algorithms on video, and you can watch 200-300 people all at the same time and measure the facial expressions. And, you know, you get, because we partnered with a company called Emotioned, and we had the license for the juries. You know, it was going along. We were really getting great work out because it can see 9 emotions. It can see confusion, frustration. You know, people can't really
when
see
that. They see that they're able to discern from a facial expression the emotion underlying the expression.
That's right.
To a reasonable degree of certainty.
Well, yeah, and you can train yourself to be 99.5% accurate with micro expressions that fast. And they have training programs for it on the internet now. And when I first got into it, they didn't have those programs. They had them on DVDs. But I hired Erica Rosenberg, who was Ekman's protege out of Berkeley, and she taught all the lawyers.
Wow, in your firm. Yeah.
Well, and my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, what I would do is I would throw these seminars whenever there was a cognitive scientist that interested me. And so you got to play with your friends for 3 days.
That's fun.
You know, instead of a 3-hour party, you had a 3-day party. And so we did that. So, you know, my kids are very good at it.
Your kids are lawyers?
Yeah, three of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
One, the other one is, she's with the State Department down in Brazil right now. But they're all very good at it. But, you know, it's complex because what you're looking for is the mix of facial expressions. It's not just the one, you know, facial expression.
Right.
When you first learn it, you put too much emphasis on one or two facial expressions.
Yeah, you did that to me the other day. I had a twitch and I scratched it, and you said, "Oh, you're showing contempt." And I said, "No, sometimes a scratch is just a scratch."
It's just a scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
If you remember, we mentioned somebody, and I thought you were showing contempt when you heard her name. But with jurors, what I'm really looking at, if when I'm actually in the courtroom, is who are they turning towards and who are they turning away from? And, you know, if you see a lot of contempt and disgust and anger, you know it ain't you.
Yeah,
But with the computer and the algorithm, we were able to do focus groups. And then what that gave us was the ability to choreograph the choreography of the case.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, the choreography of the case?
When do I want them feeling angry?
Okay.
When do I want them feeling sad? Mm-hmm. You know, and we learned some really remarkable things. You don't want those emotions coming from you. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to introduce them in the opening, and you don't want to introduce them in the closing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So because we would then have them fill out a questionnaire and give us their
in the
verdicts.
Focus group. And so a focus group is a group of people gathered together, not the actual jurors, where you're able to present some portion of the case and get data about how others are likely to react.
Right.
Okay.
And so what we saw is you really want the anger coming out of their witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have the sadness coming out of your witnesses, but it better be in the middle of the trial. You know, you don't want it at the end of the trial. And the only thing we were looking at is the regressions. You know, where did we get the bigger verdicts
based upon
when those emotions showed up? That's why and I always knew intuitively, but I didn't know why, you introduce the amount of the verdict in the opening if you can,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you want them chewing on it.
So you ask for the sum in advance, what you want?
When you hear all of the evidence, you're going to see that the fair compensation of this case is $1.8 million, or one, actually now I'm always in the hundreds.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
The because
I've tried a multiple approach because I heard a scary story from someone we both know once, and he tried a railway injury case in a person. He asked for a certain sum, and the jury gave him exactly the sum. And years later, he ran into the juror, or a juror, and the juror said, "You are brilliant. You asked us for X dollars. We were going to give 10 times more than that." So I usually anchor a minimum and tell them it's within their discretion. Risky? Should I just go for broke?
You know, the danger of putting out a number too early is you haven't really got a feel for them.
During
the voir dire, you get a feel as to what they're willing to accept, mainly because you're trained yourself to watch their facial expressions as you talk to them. But I always anchor really high up, and because the studies on anchoring are robust. The only thing people forget about anchoring is it has a very short shelf life, you know. So I don't know how, I mean, at least the research says that. So I don't know how much anchoring in the opening fixes that. But now I know what when I was trying to do that, what I was actually accomplishing.
Tell me.
If you wait till the closing and you put that amount, what we kept seeing was fear. You know, we'd see fear in the jury's facial expressions. And the verdicts showed it. You know, it was not good. Mm-hmm. And you know, as we drilled in more, it was that could happen to me. You know, I could be driving a car. That could happen to me. I don't have that kind of money. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they go into the jury room on the tail of that fear. So you want to disarm it early.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, once they're not afraid of it anymore, they're able to consider it. The same thing we saw in closing with anger. If you ran anger at them, it went down. It didn't go up. And, you know, I can, you know, all of our cases, there's always an anger element. You want them to feel that in the middle of the trial. You don't want
to. What do you want them feeling at the end?
Happy, interestingly enough. Hopeful.
That they've solved a problem or contributed something?
All I can tell you is what their facial expression was. I don't know why necessarily they were feeling it. Mm-hmm. But that's why I always want the plaintiff to be very hopeful and happy, regardless of how bad it is. I tell my plaintiffs that every tear you shed, you take $100,000 and flush it down the toilet because that's just what you did.
That's very counterintuitive to me. I mean, I don't try a lot of PI. I don't think I've ever tried a personal injury case. I've tried cases where I could get money damages for emotional distress, and they're usually police misconduct cases, and the money there is in punitive damages. And I'd be curious. Punitive damages, for those of you who don't deal with them, are exemplary damages, damages to punish or deter. Sometimes they're said to send a message to others similarly situated. Do you not want anger to underlie the emotion there, or to be the motivating emotion?
First of all, I don't know that that's what gives you punitive damages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't say I don't want it.
Yeah.
I don't want it at the end.
I hear. Okay, I got you.
The timing is critically important. And you know the type of juror that you have. You know, like if I have punishers, you know, the 10% of the population who have been given the God-given duty of punishing people, you know, those...
Are there other types? If 10% of the population are punishers, what are the other 90?
Well, remember, you're just measuring those certain attributes. But the other... Most people are cooperators. Mm-hmm. You know, they find ways to cooperate with each other. And then you have the cheaters. And about 10% of the population is cheaters, the freeloaders. You know, the ones taking advantage of everybody else.
And do you even want them on a jury?
Well, a lot of times you don't get a choice. But if I have punishers, I like punishers. You know, the more conservative the juror, the better I like it. And they tend to lean towards the punishers because I sell them, I talk about the rules. These are the rules. Can you follow them? And the rules say you compensate for these things. Can you do it? You're in trouble with it? You know, you're going to get all weepy in there and worry about the defense and, you know, be sympathetic. You know, I'm giving you the short version.
Right, I got it, the condensed version, right.
Yeah, but I kind of stumbled on that even before I had, you know, studied this stuff, because I live in a very conservative area, and one time, you know, I don't know how it happened, but I asked this woman juror, you know, I go, well, you know, could you pull the switch in the, could you execute somebody if they, if the rules said you should? Absolutely. That's who I want.
Wow. You know? Wow.
Because when you're asking for hundreds of millions, you know, it's not much different than an execution.
Now, so I get to listening to you. You know, when I prepare for a trial, I master the facts that I can assemble, whatever the discovery is, if it's a criminal case, the police reports, and so on. I try to identify legal issues, and then I let them percolate for a while and creatively try to apply the legal doctrines that I understand to the facts and laws I understand it to advance what I perceive to be my client's interest. And that sounds like perhaps I'm only doing half the work I should. I see you with a painter's smock on and a canvas and painting in the colors of human emotion. I mean, is that a bad metaphor?
You know, I used to, you know, I have a brain injury, and so as a result, the portion of my brain that's been damaged, you know, is the inhibition of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I emote way too easily. Mm-hmm. And so I've had to, you know,
Is this why you're always telling me, fuck you?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
But I've had to, I mean, I can make you cry really easy.
Mm-hmm.
I used to, you know, there's a little sadistic bent to me, I guess, because I'd be doing openings and I'd count the number of people I could get to try, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, now I know they were just reacting to my mirror. They were mirror cells, mm-hmm. were reacting to my emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It wasn't helping me because the timing of it was not good, you know. But once you understand mirror cells completely, then you have this tool at your disposal. A lot of people get really upset and think it's manipulative.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, yeah. Have you gotten pushback from judges, sure. or adversaries, and if so, how?
Well, if I'm doing it right, the judges don't see me doing it. The adversaries, what they do is they'll watch my videos and go to my presentations and think they've got it, right? And they always fall on it.
So if somebody listening, a young lawyer here, wants to see videos or wants to learn more about all this work, what tell them, what would they look for? Where do we find you?
Well, I speak to, you know, I've done Michigan, I think I did Massachusetts, mm-hmm. I've done Louisiana, Illinois trial lawyers. You know, I've been all over, mm-hmm. teaching, and some of them video it. And
they'd be on, like, YouTube or Google or,
yeah.
something like that. Are there books that people can read?
Absolutely.
Give me a couple titles that you would recommend.
Yeah, one of the books I loved was just how to do eye contact, mm-hmm. you know. And
do you recall the title? It's unfair. I didn't ask you to bring a bibliography
here. I don't.
I'm sorry.
But it's eye contact is in it. The Click, you know, by the two brothers wrote it. And it's just how to make connection quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's primarily for dating purposes, I think theirs was. But it's the same thing that happens when you're getting that bounce from the jury.
Yeah.
What are you doing to make them click with you? To make it safe. And there's steps you do. It's very, you know.
So Click is the single person's guide to dating. Is that what you're saying?
There's
a methodology to meeting strangers?
If I had read that book when I was in college, I'd be dead.
So I guess we're dead or not. Now your wife has left, so tell us, why would you be dead? Don't tell. This will be recorded.
I mean, there clearly is a science to it. And if she likes how you smell, there's not much you have to do to go the distance.
Mm.
And it has nothing to do with how clever you are or how engaging you are. You know, but primarily smell. The science on that is absolutely robust. Mm. The more different you are than her genetically, she will find you more attractive. And that's why, as soon as the taboo of interracial marriage and all had, you know, died away, and it is dying away, you're seeing this surge of children of mixed races. You know, like most of our schools here, the majority of the population in those elementary schools are mixed race.
And we're in Southern California right now.
In a Republican district. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I think probably one of the only one or two that are left. Mm-hmm. But that's science. You know, that's the science. Mm-hmm. That's and the reason for it, there's a real good genetic reason for it. The stronger the immune system of the child, the further that you are apart genetically. Mm-hmm. You know?
But I want to talk, so there's a book with eye contact in it, there's Click. What else should I be reading to see the world the way you see it?
Well, I don't know that you want to see it the way I see it.
Well, to have access to the tools that you're using.
There's Steven Pinker's book, The Stuff of Thought, I always liked, mm-hmm. although it's controversial. The Sapolsky wrote a book, Behave, Human Beings at Their Best and Their Worst, that gives you a really solid foundation, but it's difficult to read. You absolutely need to understand cognitive and abstract metaphor. Mm-hmm. And
you did a lot of work on metaphors and worked with Lakoff for a while?
No, Lakoff and Johnson wrote The Metaphors We Live By.
Right.
So we hired Johnson to come to a seminar for us. You know, what are the best abstract metaphors? What do we need to understand for juries? And that was incredibly insightful. You know, one of the things I'll do when I'm picking a jury sometimes is I'll say, I want to talk to you about the diamonds in your life. You know, those things in your life that make you want to get up, that make it all worthwhile.
And you don't get drawn an objection to that? What's that have to do with? Objection! What does it have to do with the case? Sustained, Mr. Paris. We're here to get a fair and impartial jury, not self-jury.
That's right, Your Honor. And if they can't measure the diamonds these people stole, how do I get that?
You can proceed, Mr. Paris.
You know, it depends on how much I want to fight with the judge. But I rarely have any problem doing it. Mm.
Tell us the most remarkable use.
But there's a reason for that. I want to tell you what it is. See, I don't try to get money for pain and suffering because I know there is no abstract metaphor in Western culture that pain equals money. Mm. You know, in fact, it's the opposite. Mm. And, you know, the metaphor I use when I'm teaching this is I have corns on my feet. I got them when I was about 30 years old. When I go skiing, hurts like hell, you know, the tight ski boot. I got to trim them, and, you know, sometimes I'll go and I have to go get a pedicure, and when I first started doing that, people really looked at you funny when you did that, you know, and they hurt, you know, the long or short of it, and I can't wear my cowboy boots when they flare up, and if you can't wear your cowboy boots, how can you be Mayor of Lancaster?
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
But, you know, that's the story I tell. Want to buy them?
No.
Do you want them?
No.
Come on. How much will you give me for my corns?
Oh, I was thinking about the boots. What the hell would I want your corns for?
And that's what we do. I mean, isn't that what we do with juries when we try to get money for pain and suffering, and then we wonder why it's so hard?
Yeah, all right.
Good. You know, all abstract thought is metaphoric. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, a little bit of debate about, well, maybe not all. But nobody's shown me yet where it's not all. And Metaphors We Live By is a difficult book to read. It came out in the 80s. It, for a science book, it just flew off the shelves. Mm-hmm. But that really gives you a solid, strong foundation of what a metaphor is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, can you... Again, any war stories?
I haven't finished because this is where the money shot. I'm sorry.
You know, this is why I'm still learning to do interviews. Yeah.
So what do you sell? You sell impact on the family, and you sell what was taken, right?
The diamond.
The diamonds in your life. So that's why you introduced the metaphor in jury selection. And I don't really care. I just wanted to hear the word. Because in the closing, they see the picture of the diamonds, right? And there's other things you could do. And you know, imagine there is a bag of diamonds, and the defense took it, and for whatever reason, they lost it and couldn't recover it. Did everything they could to find it. What are you going to do? You're going to have sympathy for them and discount it? are you going to take each one of those diamonds and weigh it and have an expert tell you the clarity of it and the value of each and every one of them? And I'm not talking about little diamonds. These are the ones you buy at Costco, you know, big diamonds. And then you add it up. And if it's $240 million, it's $240 million. You're going to give them a discount? You know, this is during jury selection. Because that's what they're going to ask you for at the end of this, is a discount. And so what is the value of picking up your grandchild and throwing him in the air? And he giggles as he comes down, and you grab him and you clutch him to your chest. What is the value of that? You know, and then... So, at some point in the jury selection, depending, you know, normally I save that for the closing, but somebody will say, it's priceless. And I go, yes, it is priceless, isn't it? And it's going to be very hard. And it's a difficult job to do your job in that jury room because you have got to value the diamonds. Right. You know? And, you know, it's not like it's not done.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
And that's when I do my Salvador Mundi metaphor.
Tell us that one.
Okay. Well, you know, Christie's, they sell, buy and sell priceless things all the time. It's difficult, but they sell them, and people buy them. You know, there's the story of the Salvador Mundi painting that was just found in the proverbial attic in London in 1954. And it sold for today's value of $2,192. And you always use an odd number. You never round a number off. And that comes out of proofiness, you know, which is a book on credibility of
proofiness.
Numbers. Proofiness.
That's the name of a book?
Yeah, it's a great
book. I thought I'd read a lot, but I hadn't. Okay. Yeah.
So, but they thought it was a fake. They at first thought it was Leonardo da Vinci, and then they thought it was a fake. It wasn't real. See, it's very important to emphasize that it was a fake, because isn't that what they're saying about your plaintiff, that she's faking, right? You say, you let the jury draw that themselves. But then, you know, our ability to measure got better, and we could measure the radioactive decay of the paints, and they came to the conclusion, no, this is a Leonardo da Vinci, right? And it sold last year to a Saudi Arabian prince for $842 million. So you throw that out. That's your metaphor. Right? Mm-hmm. And you do a thing because it was real.
Okay.
It was unique. And it was not a fake. And really all you have to decide here today is she a fake?
You know, I mean, that works.
That's
tell
how you
us
get
a
there.
War story or two where you were able to see, especially when you began this experimentation with cognitive sciences, where you began to see for your own eyes something that you indisputably thought was a result of the science in a courtroom in real time.
You know, at the time, we got a verdict of 15 point something million, which was, at the time we did this, you know, 15, 20 years ago. That's a pretty good verdict.
It's pretty good in my book now.
And it was interesting because she was seriously hurt, but she recovered really well. Mm. And she went on to graduate, you know, from UCLA and climbing up and down the hills of UCLA. And, you know, so it was difficult on the damages aspect, although she had a terrible scar on her stomach. And there was some question as to whether or not she still had sexual functioning, you know, whether she could feel it, you know, which juries give a lot for that, you know. But we focus grouped, and I couldn't move that over around 8 million was the best I could get. And then I worked with, what was his name, the pollster, he's the Republican pollster.
A pollster of some renown.
Right. Who, by the way, I'll tell the story on the facial expression. Anyway, I hired his company, and I spent a lot of money on it to get the language. What language? What word choices? Mm. So, her parents were affluent. They came from Mexico. She was first generation, born here, but they had. you know, I think they had 15 McDonald's by that. They were doing quite well. And, you know, we were calling him affluent, and, you know, the jury was responding to that. They didn't like giving a lot of money to somebody who was affluent, right? Until we changed it to hardworking family. Mm-hmm. Doubled. Mm-hmm. We got 15-something on it.
Wow.
And I attribute all of that to just that change in the word selection.
Now, I've listened to you for whatever time we've spent here. It seems like just a moment. And you've talked about the number of experts, pollsters, focus groups. It doesn't sound to me like you're...
Frank Luntz.
Yeah. Okay. Doesn't sound to me like you're getting a case on Friday and walking in on Monday. What do you invest in these cases?
You know, it's rare that I don't have close to a million, and oftentimes way over that.
You mean in expenses going into trial?
Yeah.
Wow.
But, I mean, look at it. You know, now we're hitting 40, 50 million routinely, and it justifies the expense. You're not gonna get that without, you know, having the experts to do it. So I mean, just all the focus groups cost a lot.
How many people in your firm?
We have just under 100 people, and I think I have, 23 lawyers?
Okay. And that's not all you find the time to do at age 69. You are now mayor of Lancaster.
Yeah, I've been that for 13 years.
Yeah, what in the world possessed you to become mayor? And tell us, Lancaster, where is it located? How large is it?
It's 160 some thousand people, but the sphere of influence is 400,000. We're right next to Palmdale, you know, and they have a like number of people, and then you have these, you know, tributaries, I guess, that are in the county.
In Los Angeles County.
Right.
About 75 miles out of L.A. right now?
Right. Okay. We're in the north east of the county.
Okay.
You know, and it's been a fascinating experience. You know, there was a lot of reasons I ran, and I really, you know, depending on who's asking changes the answer. You know, it's just the way, that's a cognitive science principle, you know.
Well, one thing you told me the other day, which I thought was interesting, is that you couldn't get to trial enough to test out the cognitive sciences, so you thought politics will put you in front of a forum and give you a laboratory for learning.
A place to practice. I mean, very similar skill levels, you know, skill techniques, skills. But more often, I'm always having, you know, right after I got elected, I go to the opening of the YMCA that they built, you know, and I just thought I was going to attend. I'm the keynote speaker. Nobody told me. No time to prepare. You know, you got to go up and give the speech. So you're constantly being presented with those challenges.
And you told me a very interesting story about how you overcome fear of speaking in a forum, whether it be court or that, to share that with everyone.
Well, first of all, you got to, you know, break down fear into its discrete elements if you want to learn how to deal with it. And, you know, I could talk about this for a week and enjoy it, but they'll bore everybody else. So.
I don't know about that, but I've committed to taking an hour of your time. We've got about 8-9 minutes left. So.
Wow, it went fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, fear is always something in the future. Mm-hmm. Rarely is it something happening to you at the moment. You know, you're afraid what the judge is going to do. You're afraid what the jury is going to do. But, you know, rarely is it happening in the moment. And you can never be afraid without a rapid heartbeat. Impossible. Because, you know, the physicality of our emotions is intertwined, and there's nothing you can do about that. They just are. You know, accept it. So deal with the physicality, because I don't know how to deal with the magic. And, you know, that's really what emotion stuff is. It's magic. None of us understand. But the physiology of it, that's very easy for me to understand, you know. So I got to bring my heart rate down. So how do you do that? Well, there's a lot of things you can do. But basically, you use combat breathing,
which
it was developed by the Navy SEALs. And it's to bring your heart rate down. Because it's really hard to shoot Osama bin Laden, you know, after your helicopter.
You are a Republican, aren't you?
Yeah. No, I am, but I really, I like the Obama administration for what they did with cognitive science.
But tell us about this Marine combat breathing.
So you breathe in at a count of four. You hold it for a count of four. Then you let it out at a count of four. and then you hold again with no air in your lungs for a count of four. That's the box. Mm-hmm. It's the four box. Now,
how many cycles before your pulse starts?
Depends on when your heart rate goes down, doesn't it? And then another way that you do is before you start that is what do I see? And then, well, you know, like we see that coffee cup, it's got a little crack in it. You know, mm-hmm. With great particularity, what do I see? Because that takes me away from this imaginary future thing and puts me into the present. You know, what do I feel? Well, you know, one foot, you know, has more weight on it than my right foot, you know. I feel where I'm sitting on the front of, you know, my thighs, more than less on my butt, you know. What do I feel? What do I feel emotionally? Well, you know, when I get to this part, I'm always a little afraid that people think I'm a nut, you know, so I'm a little embarrassed. That's what I'm feeling, you know. I want to identify that emotion because I don't want it chasing me mm-hmm. all day in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And if I identify it, it's, you know, it goes away, it dissipates. And then I do the breathing. I bring the heart rate down. And then in my mind, I don't actually do it physically, but in my mind, I snap my fingers, I'm back, you know. And
does that work, really?
Yeah.
Really done it any number of times?
Lots of times.
Hostile courtroom, terrifying audience?
You know, one time, you know, I thought it was a good idea to put a bounty on all the gangs.
Oh, yeah.
And you know,
you're talking about in your capacity as mayor.
But it came out like racist, but it really wasn't intended that way. And I just don't like people killing citizens, especially kids. You know, when I got elected, we had 24 kids die that year.
Oh, my.
2 years later, none, zero, no murder rate. I mean, but it was draconian how we did it. But anyway, so I thought, you know, because the only thing you can really do with crime is move it geographically or temporally. I wanted to move it to Palmdale, so I was going to put a bounty on all the gang members, meaning, you know, $2,000 reward for anybody that puts a gangbanger in jail. Mm-hmm. So the Black Ministerial Association wanted to meet with me, and they were hot. And this Daryl was, never met him before. He's 6'6", 400 pounds, standing over me, yelling at me. You know, about 3 months later, I appointed him to being my deputy mayor. You know, but that the idea being, you're in those circumstances, and as long as I don't react to his rage, mm-hmm. right, and deal with them as a human being, you end up being, you know, we became very good friends. And he had a point. You know, I withdrew that because he pointed out to me, he said, you know, you're going to have some neighborhood watch cracker take what you're saying, and you're going to have a Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, okay, I get that.
I'd never thought of that.
I get that. And you were open to hear him.
Yeah.
Let's move on from Mirror. I mentioned in the opening that you not only have two hats, you have four. Carthronics.
Ah.
What's...
Yes. Yeah. So a few years ago, my wife and I funded this company of scientists out of USC that are working on a molecule that will modulate inflammation and fibrosis. And so we've been at it 2 years now. We're getting ready to do human trials for osteoarthritis. Mm-hmm. We're also doing the animal studies for just longevity in general, mm-hmm. but autoimmune diseases. There's every reason to believe that autoimmune diseases can become a thing of the past.
Wow. Is this a publicly traded company at this
not
point?
Not yet.
So
not
people, yet. How do you spell it? What do we keep an eye out for?
CARTHRONIX.
And finally, I know there are other hats, but tell us about hydrogen power and the work you're doing there.
Well, what, you know, got me excited about being mayor was climate extinction. And that's a Frank Luntz term. Mm-hmm. Quit calling it climate change out there. Mm-hmm. It's climate extinction. You know, we need to put the urgency in this, right? Because that's what it is. And so, you know, I've been going all over the world speaking and learning. And you know, I went to China several times, and we brought BYD, which is we build electric buses, more electric buses.
Chinese company, BYD?
Yeah, but they build them you know, that for America, they build them in Lancaster. 1,000 employees. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really cool. But we're the first city that is net zero. We produce more energy from the sun than we consume.
Wow.
And that was been a few years now. First city that required all new housing construction to be net zero. Mm. You got to create your own electricity and store it in a battery in the garage. And there's other options to do it, but it has that same net effect. Mm. And California is now we're going to require all houses in California starting 2024. But we were the ones that pioneered that. But first, we had to be able to build a house that could do it, that was affordable. So we brought Chinese, the BYD together with KB Homes, mm-hmm. couldn't even speak English, mm-hmm. and, you know, the engineers from China. So you got two different languages. It was really quite complex. Later, the president of BYD told me she was just patronizing me, yeah. you know. But I was constantly calling them. Where's the panels? Where's the lights? KB tells us how they had to totally redesign how you do housing. And now, you know, KB is like the Apple of the home building industry.
But what does this have to do with hydrogen?
Oh, forgot about the hydrogen. Yeah, yeah. But even with all of that, we cannot save this planet. It is technologically impossible. We are so far down the path of destruction that we can't save it. And then hydrogen, see, hydrogen's always been a great way to store energy, but it takes more energy to create it than, you know. But now we have a joint partnership with Naomi in Japan, and we will be the first two cities that run entirely on hydrogen.
Wow.
Because you can do it with electrolysis, and someday I'll tell you the rest of it.
Well, look, so, you know, we've been about an hour. I don't want to keep you. It sounds like you've got a city to run, clients to represent, and a world to save. I guess I want to sign up for that brain injury you said you have. You've been telling me about that for a quarter of a century, but it scares me to think what you'd do if it was all there. Thank you, Rex Paris, for joining us on Law and Legitimacy. This has been Norm Pattis. So this is the first time I tried an interview format. Now, you know, I've known Rex for a while, so I kind of knew what questions to ask. I'd be very interested in your comments on Law and Legitimacy. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like the content, give me a 5-star rating. If you want to support the effort, look at Norm Pattis on Patreon, Patreon. My commitment in this podcast is to address critical issues that affect the world you live in, because as far as I'm concerned, the world is becoming quite bizarre, and I'm looking to build bridges and communication with people who are thinking outside the box. Rex, I couldn't imagine a better first interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.